Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Climate change is taking its toll on one of the world's coldest places. A study suggests that the Arctic may be essentially ice-free during the summer within 15 years. The study used statistical models to predict the future amount of Arctic ice, which suggested that the Arctic could be ice-free in the summer during the decade of the 2030s, most likely in the year 2034. Sea ice is frozen ocean water that melts each summer. Then it refreezes each winter. The amount of summer sea ice in the Arctic has been steadily shrinking over the past few decades because of global warming. It reached its second smallest level on record in 2019, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Sea ice affects Arctic communities and wildlife as well, such as polar bears and walruses, and it helps regulate the planet's temperature by influencing the circulation of the atmosphere and the ocean as well. The extent of Arctic ice is important to Arctic peoples, whose lands are being affected by increased coastal erosion. Conversely, the disappearance of ice creates economic opportunities, including the opening of oil fields and new shipping routes. It also affects global weather patterns. The study was conducted by scientists at NOAA, the University of Washington, and the North Carolina Institute for Climate Studies. And what scientists refer to as the first ice-free Arctic summer year will occur when the Arctic has less than 1 million square kilometers of sea ice. The thick ice sheets surrounding Canada's Arctic islands are then likely to remain for much longer, even in summer. This study was published in the journal Climate, and you can read this article in USA Today of March the 2nd. Now for something completely different. I was reading in a recent issue of Michigan History magazine about Michigan's fieldstone heritage. It says, a remnant of our glacial past, fieldstones were generally deemed a nuisance by farmers in Michigan. However, in the 19th century, builders, both amateur and professional, began making use of the state's plentiful supply of stones to build houses and schools, churches, and countless other structures. Across every region of Michigan, fieldstone buildings still stand, serving as a reminder of a rich geological and agricultural history. All over the Lower Peninsula and in parts of the Upper Peninsula, fieldstone houses were built in the latter half of the 19th century and in the first half of the 20th century. Many of them were do-it-yourself projects. In addition to hundreds of houses still standing, are fieldstone churches, schools, town halls, barns, chicken coops, tombstones, mausoleums, train stations and former gas stations, institutional and commercial buildings, and many more. By the middle of the 19th century, some higher-end homes in Michigan were built using what was called dressed field stone, which were trimmed to a block shape. And later, many other homes were made of field stones that received little to no trimming, including cobblestone structures. Cobblestones can be field stones, but not all field stones are cobbles. Relatively small and a softly rounded bean shape, cobbles that are similar in shape and size are sometimes found concentrated in large numbers. In Grand Rapids, for example, short stretches of three old city streets, all running up and down steep hills, are paved with cobblestones and still used every day. Field stones are generally found on the ground surface or in rivers and lakes, as opposed to some blocks cut from quarries at much greater expense. Quarried sandstone was used to build many old mansions and other large institutional structures in Michigan cities. Just how many fieldstone structures are there in Michigan? Hundreds for sure, and certainly thousands if counting all the structures with fieldstone foundations, basements, and porches. Take a drive through Michigan today. The fieldstone porches and foundations can be seen everywhere. And in the state's largest cities, too, not just in rural areas. Why so much fieldstone construction? Because the stones were there, actually, and still are there, scattered within the sand, the gravel, and the clay that was left behind by the melting 1-mile-thick ice age glaciers that were moving between northern Ontario and southern Ohio for more than 2 million years. According to the journal Michigan Geography and Geology, some of the thickest glacial drift that was dumped in North America is in Michigan, as much as 1,200 feet deep in some places near Cadillac, Michigan, which is in the upper part of the Lower Peninsula. The average depth of glacial drift all over Michigan, is around 300 feet. Well, land barons during the 19th century were busy clearing out Michigan's famous white pine forests. And land promoters promised that the impending removal of trees would make it possible to open up prime agricultural land. However, many aspiring farmers who settled in the northern half of the Lower Peninsula discovered that much of the area had sandy soil. Now, this was great for white pines, but not so great for agriculture in general. Later, some sandy soils close to Lake Michigan were found to be good for fruit growing. Thus, farm families struggling to make a living after 1900 no longer had cheap white pine lumber available. But most farms throughout Michigan did have an abundance of the crop that never fails. Frost-heaved rocks that had to be laboriously removed from cultivated fields, and sometimes every few years. Another factor that probably made fieldstone construction more practical was the huge increase in Portland cement production in Michigan during and after the 1890s. That increase was mainly due to advancing technology that enabled the development of the immense limestone deposits near Lake Michigan at Charlevoix and Lake Huron at Alpena, both in the upper part of the Lower Peninsula. Fieldstone construction seemed to encourage more creativity than conventional wooden or brick structures. And some of Michigan's fieldstone houses, several of which are well over 100 years old, have the name of the builder or of the first owner carved in one of the stones, perhaps illustrating the pride of building sturdy structures that lasted for generations. Perhaps the most popular decorative touch of the state's fieldstone structures is pudding stone. Technically, this is called jasper conglomerate. Usually, it's a white quartz matrix which contains flecks and pebbles of bright red jasper, black chert, and other minerals. Although earlier stone houses do not tend to include pudding stones, the material does show up, and frequently so, in the walls of fieldstone houses and other buildings that were erected after World War I. To many people, fieldstone houses have an intriguing aura of being rugged and primitive, and able to stand year after year, despite rain and wind and snow. A few families and individuals who could afford to spend more on labor built castle-like structures. And one whimsical fieldstone house is located not too far from where I'm talking. It's in South Haven, Michigan, which is around the south end of the Great Lake and north to South Haven, about an hour and a half or so. Why not go and see it and look for the other fieldstone structures, too, on your way? Ready for some future facts. These from Time Magazine, February the 3rd of this year, and it's entitled Innovations to Look Out For in 2020 and Beyond. First of all, we might look out for flying soldiers. After enabling short-hop human solo flight with their jetpack bodysuit, the personal flight pioneers at England's Gravity Industries recently demonstrated a version of the suit with a shoulder-mounted, helmet-controlled air rifle. The company declined to say whether it's working with the military on this project. Also, we might see something of this nature. Hey, ump, get a new lens. Major League Baseball could try out an electronic strike zone within the next 5 seasons, which would use Doppler radar to call balls and strikes and relay them to human umpires on the field. Last year, an independent minor league, actually the Atlantic League, became the first to test this system, and in December, the Major League Baseball Umpires Association agreed to cooperate if the automated system is called up to the big leagues. This should be interesting. I can't wait. And now, how about mushroom couture? Fashionable leather-like garments of the future may be grown from mushrooms. Companies like San Francisco's MycoWorks are pioneering eco-friendly alternatives to animal hides that can be easily dyed, textured, and sewn. Here is an accessory for health. A growing wardrobe of wearable health sensors, from pulse monitoring earrings to skin sensing tattoos, will monitor our vital functions around the clock. In the future, they could work with communicating apps that store our genetic profiles, helping doctors and AI systems detect irregularities and predict disease and customize medicines. But that's not all that we might see in the future. We're going to be collecting space junk. Defunct satellites and bits of other debris in low Earth orbit pose a hazard to communications equipment and to future exploration. So it's cleanup time. The European Space Agency plans to launch a robotic vacuum cleaner into orbit in 2025. And private companies like Japan's Astroscale are developing debris scooping equipment. Let your mind work on that for a while. We could look forward to more car-free zones. Many city centers, islands, and historic villages around the world restrict cars. The cul-de-sac Tempe may be the first of many built from scratch neighborhoods in the U.S. that forbids private cars completely when it opens this year. That's Cul-de-sac Tempe. The Arizona development will allow scooters and bikes and visiting ride-sharing services, and there will be access to light rail transport. Well, let's head for Arizona and find out what this is going to be. And then, how about some virtual reality goggles for seniors? Virtual reality headsets may become common in senior living facilities, allowing residents to simulate traveling and allowing them to interact with memory-stimulating audiovisual content. Remember that more than one in five Americans will be over age 65 by 2040. And one last future fact. At home, at the mall. As brick-and-mortar retail weakens, more owners will repurpose malls into housing, shopping, dining complexes, eyeing the demographic shifts that could create the need for millions of new senior housing units in coming years. Transformations have begun at the vacant Four Seasons Mall outside Minneapolis. Minneapolis, it's called Skyview on the Ridge in Iron Dequoit, New York, as well. And there are still others. So there are two to look forward to. And that's all for our future facts on this day. Now let's look at the environmental impact of livestock. Environmentalists estimate that eating 4 pounds of beef contributes as much to global warming as flying from New York to London. And the average American eats more than that each month. There are many ways of producing meat, but it's clear that the annual farming and slaughter of 50 billion animals for meat worldwide leaves a massive footprint in terms of land use, of crop consumption, of emissions, and water pollution. In the past 25 years, an area larger than South America has been raised for cattle grazing, and cows releasing methane from digesting grains and grass, mostly through burps, causes two-thirds of the livestock sector's greenhouse gas emissions. A landmark report in Science magazine found that avoiding meat and dairy is the single biggest way to reduce one's environmental impact. I thought it was time for some wit and wisdom to close today's show. That is to give you some quotations by famous people. It's better to scream. Silence is the real crime against humanity, as quoted in thebrowser.com. J.R.R. Tolkien was quoted in the Associated Press with the following: "Not all of those who wander are lost." And Elizabeth Wurtzel was quoted in the New York Times as she said, "You are only as sick as your secrets." Robert Frost said, Education is the ability to listen to almost anything without losing your temper or your self-confidence. And Arthur Clarke told us this: there is a time to battle against nature and a time to obey her. True wisdom lies in making the right choice. If a woman never lets herself go, how will she ever know how far she got? That's what Germaine Greer was quoted as saying in the United Kingdom Guardian. Well, now we're on the way out of today's program. And in our next program, I'm going to talk about full moons. I'm going to talk about ladders which blend in the wall that's being built along the U.S.-Mexico border. And we're going to find out how grapes feel the heat. So until then, please come back. Take care. Be careful driving, because I'm out there on the road too, and I don't want to be a target. Goodbye for today.